Welcome to the Barnes Review History Hour. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Thursday, September 22nd, 2022. The Barnes Review History Hour is a program where I will be interviewing contributors to the Barnes Review History Magazine, a bi-monthly print and digital publication dedicated to bringing history into accord with the facts, as well as other special guests. Please do consider subscribing to the magazine if you are not already. Check out barnesreview.org for all the details. And today I am joined once again by Carl Hamers, a leading contributor to the Barnes Review. All right, Carl Hamers, welcome back to the program, sir. How are you today?
Good, John. Good to be with you again.
Yeah, good. Thank you very much for taking the time. You are a contributor to the Barnes Review History Magazine, and I know you also have your own Substack page, which is carlhamers.substack.com. It's Taboo Truth. I will have a link to your Substack page when I post this podcast program. And you also contribute to the Occidental Observer. That's theoccidentalobserver.net, Dr. Kevin McDonald's platform. And it's a website that I've been following for well over 10 years at this point. It's one of the best websites out there, in my opinion. So you contribute to a number of very important publications, including the Barnes Review, as I mentioned. And today we're going to start off, we actually did a podcast, it's been probably a month ago or so, where we kind of talked about your background and your introduction into revisionism and a number of topics related to primarily World War II revisionism. And today we're actually going to focus on an article that was just published in the Barnes Review, the September-October 2022 edition. And this is our expanded edition. It's pretty lengthy. It's over 140 pages in length. And it's basically like a double edition. It's the special anniversary edition. And it's dedicated to ancient mysteries, a very interesting and fascinating topic, which obviously you're very much interested in as well. And your article is actually focused on a very intriguing subject dealing with the elongated heads that have been found in South America and Europe and other parts of the world. And I'm actually going to pull up the article right now. I have to scroll down on the PDF that I have in front of me. And by the way, this issue, this September-October 2022 edition, the expanded issue, is at the printer, and it is going to be mailed out. I know I have not received my copy just yet, but it will be arriving in the mail probably within the next week or so. So be on the lookout for that. And yeah, I'm looking at the article here. It's Cranial Deformation versus Elongated Skulls, Two Views, an Analysis of Competing Theories Attempting to Explain the Otherworldly Elongated Skulls Uncovered Near Ancient Megalithic Sites. And I'll let you kind of get into the article. I wanted to start out by just asking you how you became interested in such a kind of bizarre, fascinating topic.
As I said in our last interview, I had a man I knew who introduced me to revisionism generally. I think of him as a mentor. This was back in 2015. And along the way, in my associations with this man, he introduced me to the work of Brian Forster, whose website is called Hidden Inca Tours, who was a researcher, something of a archaeologist into what I call far ancient history, you know, far beyond the origins, which they claim was Sumer 6,000 years ago. You know, Forster is exploring far ancient history 12,000 years ago and more. So he has some research into these elongated skulls that are found in various places in proximity to these megalithic sites. So I already knew about that when Paul Angel, the editor of Barnes, approached me and, you know, asked me if he could assign me a essay for this edition. What is it? September, October on ancient history, having to do with the elongated skulls. So I already had some introduction to that. And Paul provided a source, a television documentary series, Forbidden History. and in particular, episode 4 of season 7, Mysteries of the Hypogeum, a Subterranean Neolithic Temple. So it was my idea to combine a comparison between Brian Forster's work on the elongated skulls and then the Forbidden History series and make a comparison. And Paul was glad of that idea.
Right. And that for that Forbidden History television series, the episode that you're referencing, is this where it basically presents the work of Dr. Anton Mifsud? Is that how you pronounce his name?
That's how I'm pronouncing it phonetically. Yes, he's a medical doctor and a specialist in infectious disease.
And right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I'm
well
familiar
anatomy,
with it.
Which is a very interesting combination in the case of Mifsud's theory, which we can get into, and how that compares to Brian Forster's theory.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Let's definitely do that. Before we do though, can you kind of give us just like a general overview of this topic? Where are these mysterious skulls found? And maybe talk about like the different theories that explain them. And also, who is currently investigating this topic? And how is it handled by sort of like mainstream archaeologists or scientists? Which I would assume Dr. Mifsud would sort of represent like more of a mainstream view versus the other gentleman you mentioned that has the Ancient Inca YouTube channel, Brian Forster.
That's right. Okay, there's three questions here. Where are these skulls found in the world? Basically everywhere. But they are concentrated in the Crimea area, the Caucasus Mountains between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. There's another concentration of these skulls found in Peru, in the Peruvian plain and up into the hills approaching the Andes. But they're also found in proximity to Stonehenge and the British Isles and North Africa. And interestingly, basically everywhere the ancient Aryans traveled and set up civilizations. But they have this curious concentration in these two areas. Let's see, the second question was, what are the theories that explain them? There's basically three theories. They are alien skulls from another planet and derivatives of that, the aliens that interbred with humanoids, you know, Earth-based human species. They are due exclusively to cranial deformation or head binding, which are human skulls that are deliberately distorted in infancy using various methods of, you know, attaching a plank or a board to the skull while it's still in a formative state in babies to change the shape. And the third theory being they are Earth-based humanoids, not Homo sapiens, but another subspecies, perhaps, of human beings on Earth. And the third question is, how are contemporary, what we might call court historian researchers addressing this? I did a search on that in preparation for this interview, and it appears that most of them are just dismissing it as cranial deformation, which is very disappointing. And we'll get into why. Brian Forster's theory, I'm going to spell his name if people want to look him up. B-R-I-E-N-F-O-E-R-S-T-E-R. Hidden Inca Tours is his website. You know, his theory basically boils down to the third theory, the humanoid. And Mifsud's theory is actually a different approach. His theory is the elongation of the skulls is due to an isolated population on Malta, the island of Malta in the Mediterranean Sea, combined with selection pressure, the people breeding for skull elongation because that was associated with the nobility, the leaders of the society, who Dr. Mifsud calls serpent priests. So they were fully human, but they were subject to a genetic trend for selection pressure on an isolated island population and preference for elongated skulls.
And Dr. Mifsud, in this particular episode, he's basically just analyzing a sampling of these elongated skulls found on the island of Malta, right?
Yes, that gets into the hypogeum, the underground temple that was found in 1902 in a city on Malta, which, you know, the Forbidden History documentary dates to 5,000 years ago. A really extraordinary underground carving, basically, of natural caverns into an extraordinary artwork, really, with amazing properties. There's acoustic properties to the hypogeum, and some people think even energetic qualities due to the shape and architecture. And it was in this underground temple where 11 elongated skulls were found, along with the remains of 7,000 humans or humanoid skeletons that were all in a jumble. And it emerged that they had been rinsed from the, I should say that the hypogeum is shaped in three distinct tiers, one above the other. And it appears that the skeletons were laid out in proper formation as full bodies in the second tier, and then they were rinsed into the lower tier in a jumble by an immense tsunami that flooded Malta about 2,500 years ago. So let's see, what were you asking?
I was also going to mention, we have some incredible photographs of the hypogeum of Malta in this issue of the magazine that gives readers a good view and sort of overview of what this structure looks like. And it is incredible. You know, I look at – that's another thing about this, the ancient histories – the ancient mysteries and just the, you know, ancient history in general. I'm just looking at some of the stuff like, how the heck did they build this? You know, it raises a lot of questions considering, I mean, you look at some of these photos and it's like, do you even see anything like this being constructed today? And we have all this heavy equipment and advanced engineering and architecture and everything else. So it's pretty fascinating, and there's some great photographs in this article that we have in the magazine. So
fantastic stuff.
Yeah.
Your real original question was, Mifsud was studying the skulls themselves, but he was only able to access six of them because the curators of the museum, it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site, withdrew five of the skulls from, you know, public access. You know, we should mention that UNESCO was, the first director was Julian Huxley, brother of Aldous Huxley, author of Brave New World. Highly suspect, you know, basically communists controlling the UNESCO. So, but Mifsud was able to examine six of them, and they were definitely elongated, which is defined as the width being 75% or less of the length. They call it dilocephalic. I'm not getting that right. Dilochocephalic. That defines an elongated skull. And, you know, hysteria is there basically derived from human breeding in an isolated population. So that gets in. Well, I should also mention, they say in the Forbidden History series that the hypogeum was built or carved at a time when they only had stone and wooden tools, which is impossible to conceive. And so that might lead us to Brian Forster's theory of a lost ancient technology.
Yeah, you know what, before we jump into his theory, so is it accurate to say that Dr. Mifsud, he basically concluded that the elongated skulls were something that could naturally happen, or could be basically it wasn't anything extraterrestrial or anything. It was something that could happen naturally, essentially, or humans could use head binding to make it happen. It wasn't anything out of the ordinary, essentially. Was that basically what he concluded?
Not exactly. Only one of the 11 skulls was due to head binding or cranial deformation. He concluded that the elongation of the skulls was, as you say, in a sense, natural, but with the application of human eugenics.
Okay, yeah.
The people on Malta were deliberately breeding offspring to encourage the elongated head genetics, but fully Homo sapien. There's more to say. I think that's what you wanted to know.
Yeah, no, that's kind of what I was getting at. Yeah, that makes sense. So let's turn to Brian Forrester's theory. And by the way, I was checking out his website. It is a fascinating website. This guy does he leads tours down in Peru and maybe even other parts of South America. I think Bolivia as well. You know, going to some of these ancient sites, and he seems to have done a lot of research into these ancient mysteries down there. So it's a very interesting video series he has on YouTube, for example.
Yes, there are. He leads tours to the Egyptian pyramids, Stonehenge, other sites in Europe, Machu Picchu, Cuzco, Monte Alban, all over the world. That leads to the most interesting thing from Brian Forrester. But his study of the elongated skulls now includes, in 2018, he submitted DNA samples to three different laboratories. And the results came back quite astonishing. The origins of the elongated skulls are European, basically. As I said earlier, the Caucasus Mountains between the Caspian and Black Seas and Crimea. And his theory is that these peoples, not Homo sapiens, migrated down through the Persian Gulf, and they sailed across the North Pacific to the North American coast, and then traveled down to the large bay in Peru and settled there because it was uninhabited and they could live in peace. Apparently they were chased out of their Crimean homeland area by other tribes and really other subspecies.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting, right? I mean, there have been all sorts of myths and legends about ancient Europeans exploring North America, South America. And it's something that we cover actually in this issue, but it's routinely dismissed by mainstream establishment type historians and archaeologists. You know, most people assume that Christopher Columbus was the first European to discover America, but there were Europeans coming to America, exploring America, going back thousands of years, well before Columbus.
Oh, yes. Before we go on, I have to back up and mention Dr. Mifsud's theory includes the distortion of the bones of the skull by the phenomenon of thalassemia. Thalassemia is a blood condition that's a response to malaria. And it accounts for, without going into the, you know, medical details, it accounts for the heavier brow ridge and the fusing of the sutures of the skull and the larger jawbone that are found in the Maltese hypogeum skulls. This adaptation to malaria. But it does not account for the elongation of the skulls. As we said, that's eugenics and isolated population. So that is an important point to make about the myths of theory. And as for like the presence of whites, European types in the Americas, I wrote a book review for Barnes where it wasn't able to be published, The Lost History of Ancient America. And there's a whole lot to say about that, but it pushes the presence of white European types in the Americas as far back as 36,500 years.
Wow, that is a long, long time ago, well before Columbus.
and a Greek coin was found in the Americas, which, you know, the Greek civilization was hundreds of years BC.
So, right. Yeah, we do. I know we definitely have articles dealing with that topic in this issue. But yeah, no, it is pretty fascinating, and it pretty well established that there were all sorts of explorers over here well before Columbus. But let's get back to Forster's theory. So he's basically claiming that many of these skulls the people originated somewhere in the Caucasus region, right? Is that a big part of his theory?
Yes, indeed. That's exactly it. And they migrated to Peru. He says they were born with elongated skulls, cranial deformation of their infants being performed later due to genetic mixing with normal Homo sapiens sapiens. They had red hair and were most likely light-skinned and may have had blue or green eyes. They were not Native Americans. He said DNA testing shows they came from the Black Sea area. Some of these skulls have a greater cranial volume than normal humans, which headbinding cannot achieve, obviously, right? You can change the shape of the skull, but you can't increase its volume with headbinding. And some of the volumes showed 30% greater and one even 50% larger volume than Homo sapiens skulls. There were other, what we might call anomalies from human skulls, such as the foramen magnum, the hole at the base of the skull through which the spinal cord and arteries pass, is shifted to the back of the skull and is smaller. And there are two of foramen at the back of the elongated skulls, which are holes in the skull, which human skulls do not have. And he goes on to say, these are some quotes, "No way this is cranial deformation, this is genetics. Quote, this individual was born with an elongated head and was not Homo sapiens sapiens." These are quotes from Brian Forster's video, which I linked to in the article.
Yeah, very interesting. There's also photos of some of these skulls that he is analyzing that came from Paracas, Peru. And, you know, you look at some of these skulls and it's, again, raises all sorts of questions. Do you think that there's any evidence that some of these skulls may have been a different species, may have not been human, for example, maybe some other sort of hybrid type species?
Yes, essentially, although technically the word species means unable to breed with other species. So I would categorize these Paracas people, these elongated skull people, as a subspecies, because they evidently were able to breed with Homo sapiens and other humanoid subspecies. So, and to say hybrid, a hybrid would be the offspring of the Paracas and Homo sapiens. I think the Paracas themselves were, you know, a kind of a pure breed. They, you know, what's really fascinating about far ancient history is that I read in the book, The Lost History of Ancient America, that modern day humans have a genetic variety of only 1%. But these ancient humanoid peoples had a variety of 15%. And if you can imagine the noticeable differences among races today, and magnify that by 15, you have wildly different peoples, you know, humanoids. But they interbred, you know, some died out, and led us down to what we have today, the variety of human beings today.
Very interesting, yeah. So I guess what's your overall conclusion? What theory makes the most sense and is backed by the most evidence?
Let me just mention some of the other theories, how Forster presents them. They're almost amusing. Just a moment. Well, we know what they were. Aliens from another planet and or aliens that interbred with humans, making that kind of hybrid. that they're purely humans with head binding only. But as you say, John, when you look at the pictures, it's just, they're just shockingly unlike human skulls, which we're all familiar with. So, yes, my theory, and along with Brian Forster, is that they are earthly derived, you know, subspecies of humanoids that went on to interbreed and in other ways die out. They were completely wiped out by the tsunami that overran Malta, and they were genocided by an invading tribe in Peru. But not before there was some interbreeding around the world. And at the very end of Brian Forster's video, he shows a man, modern man, sitting in an office, modern clothes, with an elongated head. And I end my essay with the speculation that perhaps descendants of the Paracas walk among us today.
So not all of them died out. Yeah, you can still see there are still some examples of you know, humans, modern humans that have, you know, not necessarily, I mean, you know, you look at some of these photos and the elongation is very, very noticeable. Maybe it's not that pronounced, but you still see some similarities. In the very last page of the article, there's also a collection of photographs of other elongated skulls from across Europe. There were some found, I know, in like Hungary, for example, in Crete, in Germany, in France, and it, you know, it's fascinating. It leads one to conclude that maybe this subspecies, as you describe them, had roots in other parts of the world as well, in other parts of Europe, in other parts of the Mediterranean, in South America, obviously. So it's a interesting topic, obviously.
Yeah, I'm glad I could get into the book, issue on far ancient history. It's definitely associated with that history. It's actually archaeological artifacts that we have.
Were there any other interesting facts or aspects of this topic that you discovered while researching for this article? Does anything stand out in your mind?
Well, the architecture itself, not just the hypogeum, which one of the later constructs of the Maltese people, but the other megalithic sites around Malta that cannot be explained by the technology and tools in existence at the time. And they basically can be explained by Brian Forster's theory of a much more ancient civilization, of which the Egyptian pyramids are included. They are not they were not built by the pharaohs 6,000 years ago. And they weren't built by, like, the Exodus theory in the Bible and the Torah of the Jews being enslaved to build the pyramids. No, no, the Egyptian pyramids and the Maltese temples and Machu Picchu and much else in the world was built perhaps 50,000 years ago, at the very earliest 12,000 years ago at the end of the Ice Age, which then ended in an immense cataclysm of mysterious origins, whether huge meteor strike or plasma from the sun striking the earth and ending the Ice Age and creating the Great Flood. And that whole civilization, which was worldwide at a time when the ice caps had extended as far north as half of New Jersey on the East Coast and the Puget Sound on the West Coast. And, you know, that same latitude all the way around the north and up from the south, the same. It's almost inconceivable how much ice there was on the earth. And the ice was miles thick from halfway through New Jersey to the North Pole. And that this caused the coastlines of the world to extend outward onto the continental shelf. And many of these ancient cities and temple complexes were built on the coastline, which are now underwater. So we have the Daggerland, ancient cities underwater off the coast of the British Isles. There's a long hundreds of miles of these underwater cities off the coast of Oregon and Washington. They're in the off the Yucatan in like so-called Bermuda Triangle around Cuba. is absolutely fascinating to me. Divers are discovering more and more of these underwater cities of like, and they're precisely aligned to cosmic positions, like hyper mathematical precision. It's really astonishing.
Yeah, it is, absolutely, and it demonstrates that these ancient civilizations definitely had some form of advanced knowledge of astronomy and sort of, you know, celestial bodies. I mean, they seem to be very much in tune with what was going on in the sky, it seems like, anyways.
The stone architecture is all dry stacked, but it's so precisely fit together that Brian Forster theorizes, and he's starting to discover actual ancient high technology, some method of cutting these stones or shaping them. And some of the stone walls appear to be, it's hard to describe, it's as if they were melted. They're sort of like the way that a marshmallow is melted by a campfire. They've sagged and then reformed. And some of the surfaces are as smooth as glass, and some of the stones themselves, and these are multi-ton stones, they're called polymorphic, which means they're not simple cubes. They have like flares and hooks on them that latch into the stones next to them, a complex pattern that apparently is part of their stability, although it may be related to the electromagnetic qualities of some of these stones, which contributes to the energetic. For instance, the Egyptian pyramids are thought by Brian Forster not to be burial chambers or tombs, but actually some kind of power station, some kind of energetic.
Some way to like harness electricity, or like harness energy in general.
Earth energy and sky energy combined. There's a masculine-feminine dynamic. There are shafts and tunnels throughout the Giza Plateau going down hundreds of feet that he thinks would fill with water from the Nile flooding, the annual flooding, but not for irrigation purposes, for some kind of masculine-feminine polarity energy system. It's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, it is. It definitely is. And, you know, you see some of the photographs of some of these ancient sites. I actually went down to Peru when I was in college, and I did a study abroad in Lima, Peru, the capital. And then I took a trip to Cuzco and did a hike to the Machu Picchu site.
Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, even back then, I wasn't like, you know, into history like I am now. I mean, I was to a certain extent, but certainly not like the revisionist aspect of it. And I just remember thinking, like, how the heck did they build this all the way back then? You know, I mean, it's very remote. It's like way up in the mountains. You know, you have to hike a couple days even to get there. I mean, it's very, very remote. And I just remember being fascinated. And it's like the official narrative, the official story, the mainstream archaeologists and scientists really didn't have too convincing of answers, frankly.
No.
And I still don't think they do today. And you look at like some of the like you were mentioning like some of the stone structures and the different, I mean, all these stones have different shapes, but they all fit so perfectly and neatly together, and they're still standing to this day. You know, a lot of these structures anyways.
They were impacted, some of them, by the great cataclysm, but not nearly as much as they should have been. And some of them actually resisted the cataclysm, which may have been part of their design function. But some of them have been pulled apart as the ground collapsed, massive earthquakes, but not entirely. So maybe the last thing to say about this topic today is people survived the Great Cataclysm, and they shifted to the British Isles. And that's from the British Isles is where civilization was renewed eventually. They traveled from there to Sumer, and then, you know, like the remnants of the ancient civilization, which we might call Atlantis. Some people say that was Atlantis, the Ice Age worldwide civilization. Then they with remnants of their knowledge, they reclaimed civilization today.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, it makes a certain to degree of sense. I don't know. I have all sorts of questions about ancient history the more and more I learn about it. And I guess it just shows you, like, I mean, you know, like I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, you know, we were talking about the concept of historical revisionism. And usually it's applied primarily to World War I and World War II. But really, I mean, I think it's important to apply the concept of historical revisionism to all aspects of history, including ancient history.
Yes.
You know what I mean? I mean, we've been, you know, certainly deceived about so many topics, and I think that deception extends to ancient history, and there's a lot that doesn't add up, according to the mainstream archaeologists and historians, that I think revisionism has a lot more answers to, or at least is honestly pursuing the truth. I think there's a lot of cover-up going on in the establishment.
Oh, absolutely. And maybe the key insight into ancient revisionism and far ancient revisionism is that the civilization builders were whites. They were pre-Europeans. They were ancient Aryans, because that's what's being covered up. Most people think the ancient Greeks and Romans were, you know, dark-skinned like they are today, that the Aztecs, the natives of Central America, built the Aztec civilization. That's all false. They were white travelers, what the natives called white gods, which, you know, heretically gives the support to the theory of white supremacy. Only whites were capable of building civilization in the far ancient times, in the ancient times, in some sense today.
Right, yeah. Interesting. Well, I hope people will subscribe to the magazine if they are not already and check out this upcoming issue, the September-October issue. It is full of very, very interesting information, all sorts of articles dealing with ancient mysteries, topics relating to ancient history, including this one that you put together, which is outstanding. So we can go ahead and move on. I'd like to talk about your Substack page and also your contributions to the Occidental Observer. And I'm curious. I know there's a lot of overlap between what you publish on your Substack page and the Occidental Observer, although there are a number of articles on the Occidental Observer website that are not on your Substack, so you do publish in both places. And I know you had mentioned you had sort of like a personal story that you wanted to talk about, addressing how you came to write about sort of, you know, like the Jewish question for the Occidental Observer. Did you want to go ahead and sort of explain that?
Yes, thank you. The editor of the Occidental Observer is also an author there, and he published a essay called "Jews and Jewish Organizations Lead the Gun Control Campaign." And another, probably the other most prolific author at Occidental Observer is Andrew Joyce, and he wrote another essay called "Jews and Gun Control, a Reprise." And each essay references the other, not exclusively, but they're related. And I read both of these in my time, you know, before I became an author myself. And, you know, the natural question occurred to me, well, if Jews are behind this attempt to basically confiscate guns in America and, you know, undermine the Second Amendment, what else are they behind? And in researching that, I found an essay on the Renegade Tribune, which is a self-publishing site. So it's, some of it doesn't have the same quality as the professional sites. But there was a very good essay called "Those Who Lead the Vax Wars Are Jews." Well, that was interesting. That was in 2015, long before COVID. And it identified quite a number of prominent people promoting vaccines who were Jewish. And then I said, well, I can write about this. What else are Jews behind? You know, what other developments in our world and history have had a preponderance of Jews pushing the agenda? So I ended up writing, like, Jews of the World Economic Forum for Occidental Observer, identifying seven of the 31 members of the World Economic Forum's Board of Trustees as Jewish. And most notably, the executive chairman of the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab. And since then, I've gone on to publish more on that. On Substack, you'll find an essay called Klaus Schwab is a Jew.
So, you know. Yeah. No, I remember seeing that. What evidence is there that he is Jewish? Do you mind going over that briefly for us?
Yes. Evidence has emerged by researchers that his mother was Jewish. Her name was Emma Gisela Tekelius Schwab. Her maiden name being Killian, Tekelius being the name of her first husband in 1919, and then I don't know what happened to him, whether he died or they divorced, and then she married Eugene Schwab, Klaus's father, in 1925. And then she had to leave Germany in 1938 when Schwab was a very young boy, maybe 1 year old, you know, ostensibly because the National Socialists were down on Jews. But she was married to a German, Eugene Schwab, who worked for a laboratory that developed weapons for the National Socialists and other industrial products, turbines. And it was recognized by the National Socialists as a award-winning company. So they weren't likely to chase Eugene Schwab's wife out of Germany. But she came to America. They have the records of her travels here, and she accompanied by another Jewish woman and came through Ellis Island. And then we lost track of her. But that's the main evidence that Klaus Schwab is a Jew, and his brother is openly declares himself as a Jew today.
Wow, no kidding. Okay, I didn't even realize that. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised that he has Jewish ancestry. That certainly would not surprise me given his agenda, right?
Exactly. I mean, yeah. As part of my research direction, I look at someone that's, you know, trying to impose transhumanism on the entire human race, and I'm like, hey, I wonder if that guy's a Jew.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they seem to be promoting all of these very subversive agendas, no doubt. And, you know, you just sort of scratch the surface and you can find all sorts of evidence to demonstrate that. One topic I definitely want to bring up is a book review you wrote for the Occidental Observer. And it is a book review of Unmasking Anne Frank, Her Famous Diary Exposed as a Literary Fraud. And it was published recently by Clemens and Blair, who, if I'm not mistaken, that is Thomas Dalton's publishing outfit, correct?
That's right.
Right. And I know the Barnes Review, we also publish and sell a lot of his books as well. So, yeah, this is interesting. I have not read this book. I am aware of some of the backstory of Anne Frank, as I'm sure many listeners are. But you read this book and you wrote a review. You want to tell us about it?
More than that. Thomas Dalton enlisted me to edit the original manuscript written by Yukio Suzuki, Japanese man. And then I added an introduction and a postscript chapter. So I have some content in the book itself. Thomas Dalton added the foreword. So it's really, to an extent, three authors, although Yukio did most of the content, most of the core of the book. But then, I wrote an essay, a book review for Occidental Observer. It got picked up by UN's Review. Some of my essays on Occidental Observer go to UN's Review, which I'm thrilled for. That's a much bigger site. It's a huge volume of traffic. But I already had some knowledge of the fraud of the Anne Frank diary, and also perhaps forgery is the right word, you know. She was not truly the author of the entries of the original diaries. There's a lot of evidence to show that a lot of people thought, I shouldn't say a lot, but the revisionists on Anne Frank, some of them thought that the father, Otto Frank, was the actual author. But the Unmasking Anne Frank book develops the theory that the author was Levy. What's his first name? This guy's history is really interesting. He worked for like war propaganda in the United States. He lived in a kibbutz and wrote a book about the diaries of the people that lived in the kibbutz. He was really a war propagandist. And he came along and his name was Meyer Levine. And Ikuo develops the theory that Meyer Levine was the actual author of the diaries. And he was, Otto Frank assigned him as his literary agent in America in the 1950s. So he had close connections with Otto Frank.
So Meyer Levine, he was a Jewish man in the United States that worked in the Office of War Information during World War II. So he was already involved in, you know, promoting the official U.S. government line, demonizing Germany and the evil Nazis.
Yes, that's right.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. So he worked directly with Otto Frank and Frank's father, and sort of coming up with this, the Diary of Anne Frank. That's, or at least it used to be, read in, you know, most public schools, and it was presented as this great piece of literature or something when it's actually a pretty vulgar and disgusting book.
That's another interesting thing. Some of the content of the Anne Frank Diary is so repulsive. I speculate it's designed to be. It's trying to normalize, prostitution and Anne Frank, examines her own genitals in detail in the diary and writes about it. It just goes on. She was a drug addict. She took valerian pills daily, just like a herbal sedative. And just all kinds of grotesquery is presented in the diary. And, the diary promoters say, well, isn't she precocious? And she's kind of ahead of her time. She has a adult sense of these things, even as a child. She's brilliant, But the diary itself says that Anne Frank was just kind of average. And her sister, Margot, was more of the, not a savant, but like a precocious child.
Interesting. So I wonder, was any of this diary, was any of it her actual, like, original content, like any of her letters or her actual diary, or was virtually the entire thing created by this Meyer Levin guy working with Anne Frank's father?
Well, that's an excellent question. That's something of a mystery. Ikuo and I believe that it was entirely fabricated. But there's some other good accounts that at least some rudiments of a diary were actually written by Anne Frank. But they were so limited and so few that it was just a tiny kernel of an idea that was expanded upon to create the diaries by others.
Interesting. Wow. I'm curious, how did this Japanese researcher, Ikuo Suzuki, who authored the book, how did he get into this topic?
Oh, let's see. An editor approached him and asked him to write it up.
Okay, so he wasn't this wasn't something that he had been like pursuing, on his own time or anything. It was something that he was sort of like commissioned to do.
Yes, exactly. He was chosen because he was an expert on like education curriculum in Japan, and knew about the. He says that the Diary of Anne Frank may be, pushed in the public school system in Japan more than any other nation.
Really? Wow! Even in Japan, I wouldn't have guessed that. I mean, I guess it doesn't surprise me, but wow! No kidding. So in Japan, they get the official Holocaust propaganda just like we do in America and every other Western country.
I can't see that, probably, but they certainly get the Anne Frank Diary.
Huh, interesting.
which is thought to be a kind of iconic story of the Holocaust itself. Anne Frank is said to be the iconic critic of Nazi atrocity or something similar. You know, that's how important the Anne Frank diary is to the whole Holocaust story. Although in the book and in the book review, we make the distinction that Anne Frank revisionism is a subset of Holocaust revision. It can be taken separately.
Right, yeah. Well, it certainly is a very important aspect of the official propaganda associated with the Holocaust. I mean, I wouldn't say necessarily on a daily basis, but on a pretty regular basis, I still see articles in the Jewish press talking about the Anne Frank diary and the importance of it and, you know, highlighting it and talking about how it's being, you know, it's canceled. You know, it's a modern book burning operation when school districts want to eliminate it from the curriculum and stuff like that. So it still is a key aspect of official Holocaust propaganda, certainly in America, and it sounds like in Japan as well, as you mentioned.
Yes, and maybe one last point that was brought up in quite a lot of the comments on the book review on Occidental Observer and when it got posted to UnReview. Commentators were interested and even excited to learn that the ballpoint pen myth was, I actually debunked that in my afterword. A lot of revisionists have claimed that the entire diary has to be a fraud because some of the entries were written in ballpoint pen, which wasn't invented until 1951. So the diaries, supposedly starting in 1942 and ending in 44, could not have been real if even any of it was written in ballpoint pen. But that actually turns out to be false. There were only two notations inserted into the diaries by later curators of the diary, written in ballpoint pen. So, you know, we want to be fair. We want to be honest historians. The Anne Frank diary cannot be refuted because of ballpoint pen entries.
You see. Yeah, I was going to say, I know that that's usually like a main talking point that I hear from revisionists is, you know, the fact that it was, some of it anyways was written in ballpoint pen, but so you're saying that that's not an accurate aspect of this?
That's right. There were only two small entries. They weren't diary entries. They were little notes that were written and inserted into the diaries by someone many years later in the 80s, I think. And the pictures of those notes are in the book. There's a lot of pictures and graphs and charts and diagrams of the building Anne Frank supposedly hid out in, the hidden annex. You know, John, just like the whole Holocaust narrative, it's just absurd.
Yeah, it absolutely is, yeah.
Logistical and logical impossibilities throughout the diary.
Have you seen any of the I think it's a three-part series. It's really long. It's like each part is over 2 hours from what I've read anyways. The new Ken Burns documentary, The U.S. and the Holocaust. Have you seen any of that?
No, I'm glad to say. I probably couldn't handle it.
Yeah. I would like to see it just I mean, I've been reading all sorts of articles about it lately. There've been a number of reviews and just, you know, promotional type articles appearing in the Jewish press. And most of them have been arguing that the film actually doesn't go far enough in condemning America. I mean, that's a big aspect of the film, is that America is partially responsible, essentially, for not doing enough to prevent the Holocaust. And this is a reoccurring theme. I remember reading an article years ago, back when I sort of first got involved and started, you know, investigating revisionism and taking a second look at the official Holocaust narrative. And Ron Lauder, who at the time, he might even still be to this day, the head of the World Jewish Congress, he was giving a speech commemorating Auschwitz and the liberation of Auschwitz. And in this speech, he basically said that the Holocaust was essentially committed by all of Western civilization. All of Western civilization was responsible for the Holocaust. You know, the Germans, you know, allegedly carried out the murders, but, you know, other Western countries were complicit and allowed it to happen and didn't do enough to protect and save the Jews. So this is like a theme that you see, you know, promoted by Jewish leaders, for example. And now it's being introduced to a broader audience with this documentary, you know, specifically an American audience, how, you know, we need to feel guilt about the Holocaust because we didn't do enough to save these people. We were restrictionists in our immigration policy. We didn't want Jews coming to America. We didn't do enough to you know, use our air force to bomb the, you know, the concentration camps and bomb the rail lines heading into the concentration camps, which of course we did towards the end of the war.
Oh, yeah.
But it's just, you know, one big guilt trip leveled against the entire world. It always has been. And now it's specifically targeting America in a very powerful way. I mean, Ken Burns is one of the most iconic documentary filmmakers in American history, you know?
Yes, I just heard just yesterday, I heard E. Michael Jones on an interview with Tim Kelly on Our Interesting Times say that the Jews are now shooting themselves in the foot. This is a huge mistake. You know, they've gotten America to back Israel, you know, the largest foreign aid to any nation. America fights Israel's wars for it. And now they're trying to blame Americans for, you know, contributing to the Holocaust. It's like they're going to alienate America. He says that it's classic chutzpah, going too far.
Yes, yep.
This is going to backfire on Jews. They should be grateful to America. Instead, they're like blaming it, you know.
Yeah, well, and think of how much money they've gotten out of this, quote-unquote, you know, Holocaust hoax. I mean, the Germans have given Israel and quote unquote Holocaust survivors billions of dollars. Even like state government, state and local governments, like the state of New York, for example, has programs that Holocaust survivors living in New York will get a stipend and special benefits and privileges and stuff like that. I mean, it's just outrageous. Like even looking at it from that aspect, they're still milking this alleged event, you know, over 75 years after it allegedly happened. I mean, it's just outrageous.
I know. Meanwhile, the knowledge of Holocaust revisionists is exploding. I feel like it's past critical mass. It's just like the silent majority now.
Yeah.
And maybe that we can lead into my essay on Substack on 9/11. Because
yeah, sure.
It turns out that was actually a Jewish atrocity against America, not Arab or Muslim.
Oh, absolutely, 100%. That was really my big wake up call, was researching 9/11, and, you know, seeing all these links between Israel and Jewish criminals in the Bush administration, for example, these neocons that openly talked about needing a new Pearl Harbor to kickstart and sort of like institutionalize this global war on terror paradigm that they themselves came up with and concocted going back to the late 1970s, early 1980s. And, you know, of course, the people involved on the ground in New York City, the people that got the World Trade Center complex privatized and put into the hands of Larry Silverstein, who just so happened to take out, you know, a massive insurance policy for acts of terrorism shortly before 9/11. I mean, you start looking into 9/11 and literally every single angle, every single road leads directly back to either Israel or a Jewish criminal in the United States that's deeply tied and connected to Israel.
Right. That was all. I feel that was best presented by Christopher Bolin in his book, Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World.
Yes.
And in my essay, you can find it on Substack. I tried to get it onto Occidental Observer, but editor Kevin McDonald had a number of requirements for it that he needed that we couldn't get to in time. So I put it on Substack, and I incorporate an essay I'd written some years ago, a smaller essay called 9/11 Was Jewish Lightning. And if listeners know this term Jewish lightning, it's when a business or a, you know, establishment burns to the ground one night, and then the owners collect insurance for this accident. And then it turns out that the owners were Jewish and they burned it down themselves. It was an act of arson. This is a classic strategy Jews use, you know, to collect the insurance money. It's called Jewish lightning. 9/11 was the largest example of Jewish lightning in world history. It wasn't just that, but like, as you said, Larry Silverstein and his huge insurance contract, you know, he basically inflicted the collapse of the World Trade Center on himself in order to collect the insurance. But it was much more than that, of course. It was the pretext to launch the War on Terror, which was clearly directed against all of Israel's enemies in the Middle East, starting with Afghanistan and then really most prominently Iraq. But quite a number of other nations, Libya, Sudan, Yemen, Syria, and ultimately Iran, that hasn't happened yet, but that's all part of the War on Terror, which the events of 9/11 was the pretext, as you said, according to the Project for a New American Century, a new Pearl Harbor, which Pearl Harbor was the pretext to launch America's involvement in World War II.
Yeah, well, and Iran has been in their crosshairs for well over a decade at this point. And I mean, really, I mean, Iran is one of the key countries that they want to undermine and ultimately destroy. And they have actually been outright attacking it in, you know, sort of covert ways. I mean, we assassinated the General Soleimani, I think was his name. I mean, that was under President Trump. That we've carried out drone strikes and other covert operations against the Iranians. Israel's Mossad is regularly targeting, you know, their scientists and political leaders and targeted assassinations and bombings and stuff like that. So there have been all sorts of interference and even outright military attacks on Iran. It just hasn't resulted in like an outright invasion like we saw with Iraq.
Right.
But, you know, these people would love to get there. I mean, they're pushing almost every day, you know, in that direction. So
that'll be a catastrophe. Iran's four times bigger than Iraq. In my essay, I feature three top Zionist Jews who are at the architect level of planning and performing 9/11. Two of them were former Israeli prime ministers. So we have Ehud Barak and Benjamin Netanyahu, real name Milosevic, you know, at the core of planning as early as 1978, the events of 9/11, you know, for strategic purposes. And then I go on to just mention a few others, key Zionists in positions during 9/11. Michael Chertoff. He was the deputy secretary of the Department of Justice, which was whose responsibility was to investigate the crime of 9/11. But Michael Chertoff instead oversaw the removal of the evidence from the crime scene, the steel girders. Ronald Lauder, who you've mentioned, he was on the New York State and City commissions that were selling off public assets to private buyers, selling the World Trade Center to Larry Silverstein, and Stewart Air Force Base in New York State, privatized that. Berlin believes the passenger jets landed there, and then the drone, the remote-controlled planes, took off. Although, this is really interesting. I didn't expect to even consider this, but Laurent Guillenot is the writer of a new documentary that came out this year on September 10th, Israel's Great Game, 9/11 and Israel's Great Game. And it presents the possibility that the planes were actually like video-shopped into the videos, and there were no actual plane impacts. And the videos that showing the entry of the planes into the buildings kind of support this. They don't impact the surface. They seem to like swim without splashing into the surface and disappear. It's very strange.
Yeah, I've been on board with that idea for a very, very long time, honestly. It's a very controversial aspect of 9/11 research, but I think it's been very, very well established just by analyzing the mainstream media videos and even some of the amateur footage that has been released over the years and subsequent to 9/11, that what we're viewing is in fact video fakery. It's not a genuine depiction of an airplane hitting the World Trade Center tower. There's actually a really good documentary explaining all this and analyzing the media's coverage of 9/11 called September Clues. I'm not sure if that rings a bell or if you're familiar with it or have seen it, but it's, if you're interested in this topic, it is absolutely something you have to watch, because they do go through and analyze the CBS coverage, the CNN coverage, the Fox News coverage, and pointing out how what we're seeing is just impossible. It's not real. It's not a genuine depiction of an airplane striking a building. And there's so many reasons why that's the case. Way too many to get into right now. But yeah, I've been on board with that idea for a very long time. And it seems like more and more people are. I mean, I think I haven't read the book that you're mentioning or seen the documentary you're mentioning. But I think that that is a very important aspect of 9/11, that we were majorly deceived that day. And a big reason why, or a big weapon in this mind control operation was the mass media itself.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what the only good challenge to that is Christopher Berlin's documentation of the Zionist Jews that, and the Mossad front companies that, like Israeli Aircraft International and Atwell, there's a few others that, like, were in the business of converting passenger planes to cargo planes, developing the software and hardware technology that can remote pilot planes from the ground. Like, Berlin actually documents the possibilities that, you know, Israelis and Zionist Jews were able to do this. But the videos, yeah, I'm open to considering that. So just to finish up here, a few other of the Zionist Jews at the apex of the 9/11 scam were Rabbi Dov Zakheim was the comptroller of the Pentagon, supposed to track the budget of the Pentagon. On the day before, Donald Rumsfeld announced, quote, "We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions." And Zakheim was responsible for that. Philip Zelikow was the commissioner of the 9/11 commission that produced the report. It was completely fraudulent. Richard Perle was on the, he was an author of the paper, the Clean Break, New Strategy for Securing the Realm, advising Netanyahu to fight a war on terror. Richard Perle was heavily involved in 9/11. He was the director of the Defense Policy Board for the Pentagon. And his colleague, Douglas Feith, was also a director of the Defense Department's Office of Special Plans and an advisor to George Bush on foreign policy. These are all like Zionists in key positions to enact the events of 9/11.
To enact them, to cover them up, to run with the narrative and, you know, institutionalize this whole global war on terror paradigm. Yeah, these are the key people that should have been arrested and questioned by, you know, if we had a legitimate, you know, law enforcement entity that could do such a thing.
That's a key point that.
But they control it. I mean, as you mentioned, Michael Chertoff was the number two in the Department of Justice. He let all the Israelis. All the Israeli spies and military operatives that were actually arrested by many of them by local law enforcement in New York and in New Jersey. Yes. He's the one that let them essentially like deported them back to Israel.
Yeah, on visa violations.
Yeah. And these are key suspects in what was going on in New York for sure.
He was also a co-author of the Patriot Act.
Right.
Which went into effect immediately. He was waiting for 9/11 and just stripped Americans of many of their liberties and freedoms and rights under the Bill of Rights. That was Michael Chertoff. His mother was one of the first Mossad agents when Israel was founded, and his father was a rabbi.
Right.
These are multi-generational Zionist criminals, essentially. So I end my article with, like, if Jews today are continually on the hunt for Nazis, you know, even Nazi guards in a concentration camp from 80 years ago, then 21 years is not too long to go after the Jewish criminals that conducted the crime of 9/11 and slaughtered 3,000 innocent Americans.
Well said. I couldn't agree with you more. Yeah, you're right. I mean, they're still going after hunting down elderly Germans in Germany and prosecuting them for being, you know, complicit and actually like participating in the quote unquote Holocaust. So yeah. Look, I agree. I mean, I think I've been arguing that for a very long time. I mean, until we can actually start making some arrests of these key people that clearly either were involved or knew something was going on or helped cover it up in one way or another. I mean, and as I mentioned, I mean, a lot of the people in New York were actually arrested. A lot of these Mossad and military operatives from Israel were in fact arrested. You know, we could start there and work our way up to the top.
The five dancing Israelis, two of them were the Kurzberg brothers. They were known Mossad agents. There were hundreds of Israelis, you know, posing as students that were infiltrating U.S. agencies like the DEA and many others. They were pretending to sell art in these government offices.
Yeah. And they were casing federal buildings. They were casing, you know, all sorts of institutions and organizations. And again, this was all investigated and documented by U.S. law enforcement. I mentioned that the dancing Israelis, they were arrested by I think it was the East Rutherford Police Department. Yep. The FBI and the DEA had extensive reports and documentation about this massive Israeli spy ring that seemed to be tied into 9/11 as well. So, I mean, it's not as if there's not legitimate information and documentation supporting all of this. It's just a matter of, you know, having the political will to actually, you know, investigate it and enforce the law, which we're very much lacking in America these days.
Yeah, I summarize it all in my title. You've heard the title, 9/11 was an inside job. I changed the I word. 9/11 was an Israeli job.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Carl, we are going to have to wrap up here in just a moment, but I want to thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me today. Your article in the Barnes Review was excellent, and I know we're going to have more from you in the future, in future editions of the Barnes Review. And I want to encourage everybody to go out and purchase a subscription to the magazine. It is very much worth it. It's a great publication. Really, again, like the last revisionist publication that's still publishing anywhere in the world, as far as I know. And you know, each issue is very unique, covering all sorts of topics. As we've been discussing, this expanded 28th anniversary edition is focused on ancient mysteries, and it's you know, a very interesting topic. So I would encourage people to check out barnesreview.org for all the details. And then, of course, Carl, you are publishing also at your Substack, which I'll have linked in the podcast program, and also at the Occidental Observer, which I will also have linked. So people can check out your work there as well.
Yes, Taboo Truth on Substack. Thank you, John. Good speaking with you again today.
No problem. Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. I will be in touch, and we'll do this again in the future.
Very good.
Take care now. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.